Since the outbreak of war in Ukraine, I've been thinking a bit about the resumption of history. Yeah, that we can no longer assume, as the thinker Francis Fukuyama did, and famously proclaimed after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, that history was over, at least the history of debate over what was the best form of government. Well, obviously, wrote Fukuyama at the time, it was liberal democracy. Well, maybe not. What's risen from the ashes of the Soviet Empire appears to be neither liberal nor democratic. And then there is China, which the West pumped billions of dollars into because China, with its cheap labour, could make all those consumer items that we wanted to buy so much cheaper than the likes of workers in New Zealand or Europe or the United States could. Only problem? Now China, too, is rich and powerful and also neither liberal nor democratic, one could argue. Now, my first guest of the week, Brian Roper, probably never made the assumption about the end of history because he's a mainly Marxist political historian, but he has been looking at China's growing influence. And just recently, of course, there was the revelation of a proposed security deal between Solomon Islands and China, which put the wind up a lot of people in Australia and New Zealand and the United States of America. Well, Brian's been thinking about that increase in Chinese power and the American response to it. He's on the line from somewhere near Otipoti, Dunedin. Kia ora, Brian. Welcome back to Nights.
Kia ora, Brian. It's wonderful being back.
It's nice to have you on. China's growth, China's power. The West made China powerful, didn't it? It invested. That manufacturing that makes China rich and powerful was all because of Western demand, isn't it?
I think that's true. John Pilger's got a great documentary called The Coming War on China, which came out in 2016. And despite the fact that that was a little while ago now, it's more relevant than ever. And there's also a great book by David Vine, Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Around the World Harm China and the World. Two things that your listeners may be interested in, but particularly the John Pilger documentary, I warmly recommend it, The Coming War on China, because I'm not very good at sound bites, Brian. I'm an academic, and I've got these big long sentences that go on for far too long for a
That's
radio.
That's all right. That's why you get onto a show Nights, Brian.
Yeah. So here's a go at a sound bite. Between 1972 and 2008, China was winning the peace. So President Obama declared war on China, and that war has been continued by successive presidential administrations since.
Okay, well, I can't remember Obama declaring war on China. So what did Obama do, because he didn't actually make an announcement, that changed things?
Right. Yes. So I kind of want to unpack that and maybe kind of actually elaborate on what I mean there towards the end, because I think that before we talk about the US response, we need to talk about China's rise, to just be clear about what it's involved and why it's been so impressive, and also why it's so threatening to the United States. Keep in mind that at no point during the Cold War was the Soviet Union's economy ever larger than 60% the size of the US economy, whereas most economists today are predicting that China's economy, no matter how it's measured, whether in terms of purchasing power parity or nominal GDP, will be larger than the US economy by 2030. Now, that's historically unprecedented right there. Everybody, particularly neoliberals, like to celebrate Deng Xiaoping's market reforms in 1978. And they did involve, eventually, over time, the systematic implementation of neoliberalism with an emphasis on maintaining low inflation, protecting private property rights to ensure that they were sufficiently secure to attract foreign direct investment, large-scale privatization of former state-owned enterprises, agricultural decollectivization, prolonged incremental market liberalization, the effective prohibition of genuinely free trade unions, scant social provision, very little progressiveness in the taxation regime, and the combination of a free economy and strong state And to this, one can add the intellectual influence of neoliberal economists like Milton Friedman. So, you know, it definitely was neoliberalism, for sure. And a lot of people recognise this, but what they don't recognise, which I've found fascinating, is that, you know, China, you know, even conservative scholars acknowledge that China is not this tightly centralised totalitarian state. It's actually a highly decentralised and fragmented state. And these reforms, which created much greater decentralisation of governance in China, took place from the mid-1980s onwards. The central government gave much more autonomy to subnational levels of government, you know, whether these be provinces, municipalities, the special semi-autonomous zones and so forth, and created one of the most fiscally decentralized systems of government in the world, where over 70% of government expenditure is actually spent at subnational levels, which is actually quite remarkable. And what it did was it created a situation where these provincial governments were competing with each other to advance these market reforms, to advance these neoliberal reforms, and they were competing with each other very successfully, it would have to be said, to attract foreign direct investment. That foreign direct investment then pours into the country and generates an absolutely remarkable rate of economic growth. Real GDP grew at an average annual rate of 10.4% from 2000 to 2010, and then has ranged between 6 to 8% per year from 2011 to 2021. Real per capita income increased 16 times between 1978 and 2014. Real output per worker increased by a factor of 12. Now, that's according to the World Bank. And growth has not been confined to manufacturing and infrastructure. China's had one of the highest annual growth rates in the world since the mid-1980s, and according to the World Bank, had lifted 850 million people out of absolute poverty by 2018.
There's a couple of things, Brian, that I'd like to mention. One is, isn't that a wonderful argument for those who support free markets? Look what free market capitalism did for per capita income for people in China. Look how many people were lifted out of poverty and dependence on unreliable relative subsistence in terms of agriculture into a more modern industrial lifestyle. Look at what they did, those reforms did. And then I guess the other thing is that at the same time, in the West, we were benefiting from this massive commodity boom. It was almost like a commodity boom, wasn't it? But the commodity was Chinese labour.
Yes, I mean, that's absolutely, I mean, I think that's the case. I think that there are some real complexities there in terms of saying that neoliberalism works. I mean, you know, because it, really interestingly, what we see in terms of trends of inequality is exactly the same sorts of trends in China that we saw in here in Aotearoa when we had our implementation of neoliberal reforms between 1984 and 1999. In other words, we see a very steep rise in inequality. There are now more billionaires in China than the United States, and there are more billionaires who reside in Shanghai than any other city in the world. So, you know, yes, people were raised out of poverty, but the growth, the benefits of this growth have been highly unequally distributed.
And this is something and the other thing that I actually was discussing this with Eric Crampton, who thinks about these things from a larger libertarian point of view with the New Zealand Initiative last time he was on. And one of the things that I'm concerned about, I guess, selfishly, is that China is a model for a relative free market to exist within a relatively unfree society. And if the free market can work in China, does the free market need democracy anyway? Because a lot of liberal Democrats, a lot of people, neoliberals, would argue, yes, it does. But yet I wonder whether it does.
Well, clearly, you know, it doesn't. You know, I think one has to be like the more you read about China and the more you research it and the more you listen to Chinese people, you know, in interviews and so forth. And furthermore, if you look at the ASH Center's survey data, the ASH Center's based in Harvard University. So it's really hard to get reliable survey evidence to give you an idea of how popular or unpopular, you know, the central government is in China. But what the ASH Center survey findings indicate is that the central government in China is actually has incredibly high satisfaction ratings. And, you know, the sort of satisfaction ratings that most governments in Western liberal democracies would, you know, would be absolutely thrilled to get. I think 93% in, from memory, 2016 were satisfied with performance of the central government. They become less satisfied as you go down from the central government to the provincial government. But even the Alliance of Democracies 2021 poll, 71% of Chinese consider that China has the right amount of democracy. So it's a fascinating country, Brian. And you know,
I don't know how many Uyghurs were interviewed in that poll.
Yeah, well, it's possible. But, you know, no, but we're talking here about polls which are independent of the Chinese regime. And in view of the economic transformation that has taken place, and the fact that for three decades now, the majority of Chinese people have experienced a substantial improvement in their material standard of living, the fact that in their daily lives they do actually experience what we would consider to be freedom, you know, freedom of movement and freedom of to purchase various sorts, you know, various sorts of commodities and to do various things with your lives, including be tourists here in Aotearoa. It's not the kind of really nasty totalitarian regime. Well, I don't like using that term totalitarian. It's ideologically loaded. I shouldn't have said that. Scrub that. But, you know, it was a very nasty dictatorship that was based on fear and internment and imprisonment and torture. You know, the Stalinist regime in Russia I'm talking about. Now, clearly, the regime in China is qualitatively different to that.
Again, the Cultural Revolution, the famine. I could even ask people now in Hong Kong how they feel about China's regime, the plight of Uyghur people, Uyghur minorities. There are counter arguments there, aren't there, Brian? And they're pretty big ones.
Yeah, I've got actually a PowerPoint slide I use for a lecture on China versus the US, a critical balance sheet. My bullet points on China are invasion of Vietnam in 1979, refusal to grant independence to Tibet, oppression and mass incarceration of the Uyghur people in Xinjiang, suppression of democracy and free trade unions at home and in Hong Kong, and aggressive military manoeuvres and diplomatic posturing in relation to Taiwan. We hear plenty of that in the Western media. We don't ever hear about the bullet points on the US side, including CIA backing for Suharto's rise to power in Indonesia, resulting in the deaths of around 500,000 members of the Indonesian Communist Party, the American war in Vietnam resulting in the deaths of over 1 million Vietnamese people.
I'm thinking those are examples from what the US regimes of the 70s did. And if you're going to compare, then you've got to go back and talk about what China did in the 70s, the sort of things that China sponsored then, and what happened in the Cultural Revolution. Isn't it a little bit unfair to be really like laying those bullet points, those bad bullet points in the United States with things that they were doing in the early 70s at the height of the Cold War?
What about the world's highest incarceration rate and around 2.8 million predominantly Black and Latino Americans in prison as we speak?
Right. That's more current. I'll give you that.
If you're talking about mass incarceration in China, what about mass incarceration in the United States? What about a government that is spending $778 billion on the military in 2020, 3.7% of its GDP, which, by the way, compares to $252 billion For China and 1.7% of its GDP. So one of these two countries is spending a hell of a lot more on military. And then you factor in not just that military expenditure, but the military on prisons and, you know, essentially the criminal and justice system in the United States. And what about the ongoing blockade of Cuba to this day? What about extensive military and covert intervention in Central and Latin America? What about the Marshall Islands, where Marshall Islanders were essentially used as guinea pigs to investigate the long-term impacts of exposure to fallout and radiation?
Mm.
What about the 750 military bases that the United States has all over the world? What about the fact that it has 120 military bases in Japan, 73 in South Korea? Now, this is directly proximate to China and was part of Obama's pivot. So
Now, that's actually, that brings us back to, well, before I ask you about that, the US response, I want to ask you this, Brian. What was your response to the news that Solomon Islands was working on some sort of security deal with China?
I was just flabbergasted. I couldn't, the amount of focus and attention on this. I'm also continually surprised by how unrealistic some realist international relations scholars are when they use the term aggression. So if we look at, because we should sum up, we're actually talking about the US response, right?
Yes, and answer that question, because your answer is interesting so far.
Okay, so we have Obama is concerned about the scale of the trade deficit with China, and is concerned about China managing its exchange rate to keep it lower than it should be, which helps China to have, you know, this huge trade surplus.
Brian, I thought, no, let's talk about your response to the discussion on Solomon Islands first, and then we'll move on to the US response.
Okay. So, you know, at the beginning, I said the US were losing the peace in their relations with China, so Obama declared war. What I mean specifically by that is Obama's pivot to Asia, in which 60% of US military forces would be focused on the Asia Pacific, and in particular, focusing on containing China, encircling and containing and curtailing China militarily. So it is utterly hypocritical for the United States, the Australian government, and the New Zealand government to be expressing concern about China developing a security deal with the Solomons when the US has bases all over the Pacific and just off China's coastline. Like, this is aggression. And then it's running carrier groups through the South China Sea, saber rattling off China's coastline. It's you know, it's phenomenal. So China has become a world leader in developing infrastructure. Its Belt and Road Initiative would be the largest international exercise in infrastructural development in human history. It is doing this for its own interests to increase its geopolitical economic influence, but it is quite remarkable. And so we're going to see more Pacific nations probably going, oh, actually, we wouldn't mind a bit of help with the development of our infrastructure. We'd certainly prefer that to repeated nuclear tests on one of our islands that will end up poisoning those islanders for generations.
2008 was the GFC. And that ended with Western nations, a lot of them, including the States, heavily in debt, China in credit, at least at that point. So maybe it's no surprise, after those years, that peace that you say that the West was losing, and which for a chunk of it, China took over as the world's major manufacturer, that the United States might begin to realize, we're falling behind here. We need to regain some influence, because the way things are going, we're losing it fast.
Great point, Brian. Great point. I mean, if you look at relations between China and the United States from 1972, right, which goes back to the Nixon administration, the Shanghai communique, which recognizes, you know, the one China policy and establishes normal diplomatic relations. The US develops a friendly relationship with China because its primary foe at that point was the Soviet Union, right? Then from 2008, we have Obama's pivot, but then things really change with the global financial crisis of 2012. And we have very different responses to that. I don't have time to go into that now, other than to say that China responds with massive investment in infrastructure, going from, for example, 0 kilometres of high-speed rail network in 2007 to 37,000 kilometres of high-speed rail network by the end of 2020, and it's carrying more people than any other high-speed rail network in the world. Conventional railway lines go out to 143,000 kilometres, and then there's a very long list of other aspects, you know, of this infrastructural investment. In contrast, you know, the US responds very differently, and it doesn't invest in infrastructure. Fast forward to Trump. Trump's saber-rattling and racist rhetoric. And then we have, of course, the tariff war launched in 2018. And since he's been president, Biden has continued Obama's pivot and Trump's tariff war. So when I kind of gave that soundbite, it was a bit tongue-in-cheek, right? Of course, Obama didn't declare war, right? But what it did do was it signaled a dramatic intensification of the US strategy of containing China's rise. And it's been doing so increasingly aggressively, not least of which supported by its lapdog, Australia, who since Abbott became prime minister, he oversaw a dramatic increase in Australian military spending, which just hit $44 billion in 2021, you know, the nuclear-powered submarines, the new frigates joining the carrier group in the South China Sea, and rhetoric designed to, you know, to counter, you know, China's influence in the region. So, you know, we're looking, you know, John Pilger's The Coming War Against China. I mean, I think it's pretty scary, actually, when you look forward.
But
you
maybe know, China doesn't, maybe that pivot is about to re-pivot. Given that in 2008, Obama probably thought things in Europe were pretty well contained. 2022, that's not the case anymore. And maybe the focus is about to change.
Well, I think one of the effects of the mounting aggression towards China has been, of course, to push China towards Russia. And then you're looking at Russia as being, you know, one of China's allies, and you look at the fact that Russia has done very, very poorly in its, you know, illegitimate, illegal, and immoral invasion of the Ukraine. But I think in terms of US strategy, you know, I think it's great. You know, there was the quote from I forget the figure, but it was that the US was in NATO to keep Germany down and Russia out. And I think if you think about that, you know, of course the US don't want to see, you know, Ukrainian people being killed by the Russians in the Ukraine. But certainly in terms of US geopolitical and strategic interests, this has done them no harm at all. It's driven a wedge between Russia and the EU. It's led to European governments spending more on their military. It's actually served the US quite well, actually, in terms of its overall strategic interests. So, yes, we are moving away from, we've gone in the post-war era from the Cold War, where we had two superpowers competing with each other, the Soviet Union and the United States, to a period from 1991 through to 2008, where the US was the globally dominant superpower, and there was no other competitor within cooey of it, to the period from 2012 onwards, where we are moving towards what's been described as an asymmetric multipolar order, in which the US remains the world's dominant power militarily, but China is rising fast and improving its military and actually, in terms of its command structures and so forth, increasingly modelling its military on the US military. And it's becoming the world's second most powerful nation, both economically, militarily, and I think it will become increasingly influential geopolitically. Then we've got the other great powers under those two, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Japan, and so forth. And so it's an interesting, you know, the 21st century is certainly a very interesting period of human history, which is not over.
No, most definitely is not over. Brian, final question. I've given you about 90 seconds to answer this, but do you think it's inevitable that China's influence in the Pacific will grow and the United States will have to accept that? Do you think that might even go to the extent of Taiwan eventually becoming part of China again?
Yes, is the short answer, although I think, you know, it was interesting. China is mainly concerned about preserving its own direct security. I mean, it's been surrounded by all of these US bases. So it is primarily concerned about the South China Sea and its immediate region. It's not at this stage projecting a blue water navy which can compete with the United States. But certainly if we look at the period from 2030 onwards, once China's economy is larger than the economy of the United States, then of course I think we're going to see its geopolitical, economic, and military influence increase on a global scale.
Brian, it's always fascinating talking with you. Thanks very much for joining us again.
Thanks, Brian.
That's Brian. Thanks, Brian. Good night. Brian Roper, political historian, mainly Marxist thinker from Otago University.